It's time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today, the radio show where we speak about sleep and the scientific basis behind sleep. Our goal is to educate the public and help you get better sleep. Today we're going to be talking about dementia and the relationship between sleep and dementia, and we have two incredibly important guests. We have Janet Hamada Kelly, who was with us before. She is with the Alzheimer's Association. And we have Dr. Cazares, who is working a lot in the field and has a lot of the background medical information to speak with us about. So welcome to you both. I wanted to start off with Janet, and maybe Janet, you can tell us a little bit about your background, and then we can move over to Dr. Cazares.
Great. Thank you so much for having us on today. I'm really excited to be on to talk about, you know, to elevate and raise awareness around dementia, brain health, and cognitive decline, but of course to have Dr. Cazares on as well to talk about, you know, the importance of sleep and and how that connects to dementia. So my role here at the Alzheimer's Association is the executive director for the San Diego Imperial Chapter, and what that means is I oversee the local chapter in not only raising funds that go to support clinical research around dementia, but also in order to provide care and support and education resources to our local community. So our chapter staff work with different community partners to ensure that we are elevating this cause in the community and raising that awareness.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, thank you for joining us again on the show. We love to have you. And Dr. Cazares, I have to say you have a very impressive resume, and I'm very honored to have you here today.
This is fun, and thanks for doing this work. I'm currently here at Sharp in San Diego, so I have dual-hatted at a clinical role as the geriatric psychiatry medical director, so working directly with patients and overseeing care on our inpatient and in our intensive outpatient program for geriatric psych. And then I work as the principal investigator at the Sharp Neurocognitive Research Center. It's a lot of words, but essentially we do research, and all our studies right now are in the area of Alzheimer's, although historically we've done work in psychiatry studies and actually probably will be branching out in that way again. But the team is extraordinarily experienced in doing this kind of work.
Well, thank you so much for the work that you do. And I'm going to ask some questions that are probably pretty basic for you, but I think they're important questions. And I expect to learn a lot on this episode.
Sure.
So let's start off with this. We hear the word Alzheimer's. We hear the word dementia. We typically relate it to elderly patients. But in reality, can you give us a generalized understanding of what is the terminology? What is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's? And does it only apply to elderly? What are we really talking about here?
It is a great place to start. Really, this term dementia, we need to think about it like an umbrella term. The way we use the term cancer or pain, it can really have lots of subtypes. And if we start from that framework, we can understand there's common symptoms to all the different subtypes and then some unique differences as well. So Alzheimer's dementia is really our big bucket, our most common dementia, and that is a unique disorder under that umbrella. Mm-hmm. We see other types, vascular dementia, you may hear the term Parkinson's related dementia, people have dementia from more rare diseases like Huntington's. We can also see dementia from things like substance use disorders and extensive substance use that can really damage brain functioning. But all these syndromes, disorders together share the characteristics that we have progressive neurocognitive impairment. So what that means is nerves and thinking not working as well as they used to. Our brain is really a very highly organized big bundle of nerves, and it has a expected way of functioning and doing that efficiently. Over time, there are some normal decreases in that efficiency. So older adults maybe won't pick up a new language as quickly as a young person can, but an older adult can pick up their phone and download any number of apps to learn a new language and do so. It's when the loss in efficiency progresses to a loss in ability to carry out day-to-day functions. When those sort of the forgetfulness, the difficulty with speech, the difficulty with orientation, where am I going, really starts to impact that person's ability to function. And it is progressive as far as we understand with current medical science. We're not really able to reverse that process. But that, I think, would describe the basics of how we think about dementia and the different subtypes.
Great. Thank you for that. And I definitely want to dig deeper into all these things. But let me start by asking Janet a question. So you work with the Alzheimer's organization. So obviously we've got that word Alzheimer's, which I understand now is a subtype of the umbrella dementia. Does your organization just focus on one thing?
So we do, our name does have Alzheimer's in it, but we support all other types of dementia as well. I think because Alzheimer's is the most common and most recognized type of dementia, we do reference that mostly. But we really focus around brain health and cognitive decline. So we are really looking at, you know, all types of dementia and really supporting those individuals living with the disease as well as the caregivers that are significantly impacted throughout the journey as well.
For sure.
Yeah, that's a really important point. It's not just the person living with whatever form of dementia it may be, but the caregivers are really stressed, or can be when it comes to that. I certainly understand. So, all right, let's kind of move forward to learn more about this. So, we hear the word, and Dr. Cazares, as you introduced the work that you do, you said working with geriatric patients. Is it always geriatric that we're concerned about when we think of dementia? I mean, that's typically what I think of, but does it happen to other people who are not elderly?
It would be pretty rare for us to see a dementia in someone, I'll just throw out, in the rarest forms of Alzheimer's dementia. We might see in the early 50s. That's the rarest subtypes. But really, this is a disorder that we see later in life. Even in the case of, you know, I mentioned people can have dementia from, say, chronic alcoholism. It takes quite a bit of time to get to that stage. The brain and the body are pretty resilient. and so a normal amount of, like I said, inefficiency and decline is built into the system. But what we're seeing, even in Alzheimer's dementia, when someone now has symptoms, they're getting lost. They really can't remember basic information, names of folks that they should know. The disease process has probably been ongoing for a good 10 to 15 years. And we just haven't been able to detect it with the modern, I mean, the day-to-day clinical skills that we employ in healthcare. Now, that's what we look at in the research setting. How can we identify it sooner? How can we get ahead of the process? But what we're seeing is really the near end of a process that's been going on in the brain for some time. So to answer your question, unlikely that we're seeing this really in anyone, certainly under 50. And in general, when we're thinking about Alzheimer's dementia, we're in the later 60s, 70s, and the risk increases over time.
Wow. Interesting. Okay. So I'm going to ask a question that may sound silly, but I think it's a question that many people might have, which is, can you catch Alzheimer's or dementia from someone who has it, number one? And the second part of the question is, do you, other than you were talking about alcohol, do you do something that causes you to get it, or how does it work from that perspective?
This is really important. So The good news is dementia is not contagious, so we can't catch it. It's not viral or bacterial based. What we can do, and I mentioned briefly that even small interventions midlife can actually really mitigate our risk. Lifestyle modifications, and for those of us that are around young people, little people, children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, the things that we teach them in youth about physical activity, good nutrition, avoidance of dangerous substances are actually the exact things that minimize our risk of dementia down the road. So it is very clear that we say comorbidities, or in fact multiple morbidities, diabetes, heart disease, vascular disease, pulmonary disease, these are the sorts of things that impact brain health. And so the more common those are, the higher the risk of dementia. Interestingly, we also know that psychiatric illness, so for example, depression, and we're going to talk about insomnia. If we can put that in the, you know, any general non-psychiatric or psychiatric bucket, also increase the risk of dementia. And that's really a bi-directional function there. So dementia also increases the risk of those things. But they're really, you know, as we think more about depression and other psychiatric illnesses, we're coming to say this is a systemic process, not just a something is, you know, disordered in someone's thoughts. And those also increase the risk of dementia.
Well, okay. So it's good to hear that it's not contagious. But prevention and, you know, lifestyle and food and the things you're talking about are so important to help us. So let me jump over to Janet for a second and ask, does your organization have any resources or things that focus on prevention, or is it all support once someone has dementia?
That's a great question. So I think we do have lots of resources for those once they receive the diagnosis and need to understand kind of what that continuum looks like. But because there's been so many advancements around studying prevention as well as early detection and screening, we have expanded our offerings in terms of education and resources to really talk about brain health. So all the things that Dr. Cazares just shared around the lifestyle modifications, we have classes around that, and especially trying to educate those who are in the sandwich generation, so taking care of, you know, an aging parent and children, to really make sure that you are making this to be a part of your lifestyle, right? So whether it's getting sleep or increasing, you know, having a nutritious diet, or even challenging your mind. And so we do, we really are sharing a lot more around brain health and the importance of brain health, so that folks understand that there are things that they can do earlier in life to make sure that they are setting themselves up for success.
Yeah, and if I can just say one thing, Jenna, sometimes your organization, I know, talks a lot about good heart health is good brain health. Sometimes people get a little bit startled by this idea of brain health. What is, like, my brain's lifting muscles? What do I have to do? That sounds complicated, you know, or lifting weights, I should say. But it really is about good systemic health, right? So if it's good for your cardiovascular health, going on a walk, not having the extra drink that night, probably choosing the salad instead of the fries, it's good for your brain too.
So, you know, one of the things that I'm hearing here is kind of, it's good to hear it, but it's also scary a little bit, which is many years before you actually see outward symptoms of any sort of a dementia, things have already been going on in the body. So, you know, number one, I guess it's good for those people who are getting educated early on so that they can indeed work on these things. And I think that's an important piece here. I have a question about this that I want to bring up next, which is some of the books that we're seeing as popular bestsellers. But before I do that, I need to stop for a commercial break, and we'll be right back.
Have you ever wondered why you can't sleep well? Well, there could be lots of different reasons. In order to figure it out, I wrote the book, Why Can't I Sleep Well? It includes 150 common sleep questions that are asked and answered, and I provide all of the supporting science and evidence to address each of the questions. I encourage you to get a copy of Why Can't I Sleep Well by Andrew Kolsky. It's available at www.sleepsciencetoday.com.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
All right, we're back on Sleep Science Today. We're talking about dementia. We're talking about prevention. You know, there's a lot of really well-selling books that I see out there in the last several months even about preventing dementia or reversing dementia or changing dementia. Is there anything to that? Like, why is this becoming so popular all of a sudden?
I think Janet or I, we could both jump in here, but there's really increased awareness. We're seeing this in the press. We are seeing the results of some longer term studies. A study I just recently spoke about was a 30-year study. So sometimes there's time that has accumulated and now information is available to us. Certainly the accessibility of information it helps as well. But I would say there's a increased awareness in the population, and that is not only a result of studies that are coming to fruition, but the fact that actually we have in the U.S., I can speak for sure, and in some European countries, a aging population. We're seeing this in Asia as well in some areas, and the sort of pyramid, upside down pyramid that's led us to having this older population now is making the general population's experience with dementia more common. So parents, aunts, uncles, etc., who people really see with this disease.
And is there a genetic component to this, so that if I have a parent or grandparent, aunt, uncle, someone who has dementia, is my risk higher?
Again, because of those comorbidities that really do increase the risk, it doesn't necessarily mean that because mom or dad or aunt had it that it's going to be present in their offspring, their children. That said, there are genetic risk factors that do increase the risk, and we always get one gene from mom and one gene from dad. So generally we have a mix of those. There is ApoE is one of the genetic risk factors we look at. There's a ApoE2, which is protective against Alzheimer's dementia, ApoE3, which is neutral risk, and ApoE4, which is elevated risk. People who are 2-4, 4-4, 3-4, it doesn't mean that person is going to get Alzheimer's dementia. So it's a combination of the genetic risk factor with the lifestyle experience that, as is the case with almost every illness, that really gives us the end result.
Great. And I guess the related question to that is, because we know that it starts before we actually see it happening to us, are there any blood tests or saliva tests or any kind of tests that we could go to our doctor and get to see?
Right. Not currently. Many in development. So this is one of the things actually that we work on here, and the we're one site in sometimes international studies that are from large pharma sponsors generally, but some grant studies as well, that not only look at this maybe XYZ experimental drug and how it affects the progression of dementia, but how a blood test at certain stages might correlate with, say, a brain MRI or a brain PET, which is a different scan. So the goal is to get to a blood test that actually is reliable, and then those will be, of course, kind of through the FDA approval process as that we have it here in the U.S. But right now, no one's suggesting folks going to their doctor and requesting blood tests for dementia. We're just not there. And again, because it's so varied, it's not quite clear what that would mean.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. That's a little bit scary, the fact that you really don't have any way to know until you see outward symptoms. So,
yeah, ahead. I would just say this is the case with many things. We think about dementia as a very scary thing. Illness is a life change for sure. Any illness, a significant illness, there's a point in time where we're unaware and it's happening. And so really health, we could get into mindfulness and how good psychological health can build resilience. But yes, this is the case with dementia for sure.
Wow. Okay. So this next question is sort of the first part is to the doctor and the second part is to Janet, right? So the question is this. This is a sleep show, so we talk about sleep.
Right.
And my question from the medical end is, what do we know today, if anything, about any sort of correlation or causation between sleep issues and dementia issues? And the second follow-up part of the question for Janet is, does your organization have any resources or help for people to improve their sleep? So let's hear the medical side first, and then let's hear the practical side.
Right. I would say as a medical community, we have just underestimated the real importance of sleep just across the health spectrum. In the U.S., we're famous for kind of holding a badge of honor as to how hard we can work and how little we can sleep. That is probably a very unhealthy way to live as far as mortality goes. But there are great studies, actually, that demonstrate this link. Again, I would say bidirectional with insomnia and dementia risk. So when we started and talked about interventions in midlife, it's really, I think, important to have the awareness that sleep deprivation is not something we just kind of think, well, I could just have a busy week and then put some sleep back in the tank on the weekend and then do that again and make another deposit. And like I can withdraw and deposit, withdraw and deposit. The brain does not like that. And so it's some real consistency in sleep. It's similar to exercise, right? Similar to anything. If we think about just doing it in spits and spurts, it just doesn't really develop well over time. And so sleep really is an essential function across the board. It's a risk factor for many illnesses, now we're realizing, if people don't get enough sleep. But there's clear demonstration of even in midlife, 50s and 60s, people who are getting, say, 6 hours of sleep or less have significantly elevated risk of dementia. Now, those are association studies, so there are probably other things happening in that person's life. If they're getting 6 hours of sleep or less, that perhaps they are working two jobs, perhaps there's other stress in their life, perhaps there's pain that's keeping them up. Other things can be factors, but sleep has been now biologically demonstrated to be a risk factor for dementia. Insomnia, I should say. Poor sleep.
Right. Wow. Okay. So I have some follow-up questions, but Janet, I'd love
right.
to hear, you know, is this even on the radar for your organization, sleep issues?
Yeah. So the association does have resources. We have a very well informed website with lots of information. I actually came to the association as before I became a staff member, I used the website, and it was around trying to understand how to get my loved one to get more sleep, to get, you know, to stay asleep, those types of things. So our website has wonderful resources, but also I would say our 24/7 helpline. Our 24/7 helpline is available in lots of languages, and we have master level clinicians that are available to support any question. So if it's as specific as, you know, how to get your loved one to, you know, to listen to you, to get back to sleep, or questions around, you know, I'm getting consistently, you know, I'm not getting sleep, or whatever that might be, our clinicians are able to support that. And I think really for us, it really is just, again, around being able to provide the education. So when we say education, not just the information, but connecting to clinical trials. The more participation in clinical trials, especially those around, you know, sleep and lifestyle factors, I think will help us unlock a lot more discoveries to help us advance as we move forward.
Wow, well, I'm really pleased to hear that you have so many resources and you put so much time and energy into all the aspects, but at least including sleep in that is so important, because we're seeing how important sleep is just across the board, regardless of the issue. So, you know, with that, I have a technical question that I've always, you know, been curious about, because I spend a lot of time reading the current studies and things just to keep, you know, current for my own practice. And doctor, this is a question for you. So in the studies that I've read, I realize there's no study that I've come across anyway that has a very, that shows a specific correlation between sleep and whether or not it causes dementia or dementia causes sleep issues. There's the back and forth arguments I've seen. And tied into that is the question of sleep medications. So with that background, here's my question. I know a lot of people who have trouble sleeping, especially as they start to get into their 50s, 60s, etc. They may go to a doctor or a sleep doctor, and they may get a sleep medication. Now, my understanding is that most sleep medications out there will act as a sedative. They may help a person fall asleep, but then they bring them to a level one, level two sleep, but never really level three sleep. And in my understanding, level three sleep is where the brain sort of cleans out the amyloid plaques and those things. Can you speak about that whole process? What is the current knowledge in the scientific community? And are sleep meds helpful, harmful, neither? I'd love more information on that.
Yeah, there are a lot of studies, and I'll just say I'm not a sleep expert. There are sleep experts and people that study sleep specifically. That said, the link between insomnia and the risk for dementia has been well demonstrated. The actual biologic process is not, you know, well mapped out. The treatment of insomnia, I'm just going to put it aside for a second, but I'll come back to your question. I think it's important to just acknowledge that there are normal changes in sleep patterns that happen in different stages of life. So, you know, we see this with babies into toddlers into teenagers. There's sort of this, like, we have this idea that there's this static period of adulthood where we should have established sleep. Probably fair biologically. And remember, we didn't didn't come onto the planet with life expectancies into the 70s and 80s. It was much shorter. So now we're in this change of sleep later in life, and we know that there is something called phase advance. So sleep changes where people go to sleep earlier. They do have more nighttime wakings, and then they'll wake up earlier. But overall, the sleep architecture, as it's called, that you're talking about different phases, should still occur. When that gets disrupted, then we really need a clinical kind of evaluation. Short of people doing their normal healthy interventions, is it difficulty falling asleep, staying asleep, both? And then what are the, as we call them, sleep hygiene patterns? What does someone do to maintain their own good healthy sleep? So there are normal changes that occur. That is not pathologic. It's not a disease. That just happens. And as long as people are maintaining sleep, there's questions out still about whether napping is helpful or harmful. So looks like shorter naps, okay. Longer naps, probably not. If someone's sleeping enough at night, enough being 8+ hours, then napping is probably not great. If they're sleeping less, and I'm talking about in the geriatric population, napping is probably helpful. But these are all still questions out there. Now, in real life, someone say, I'm tired, I'm going to take a nap. That's probably unlikely to change a dementia outcome. So the research around this is, what advice can we give ultimately to people in midlife to set themselves up for less risk? To your question about medicine, I think when we look at real guidelines on what's effective, non-pharmacologic interventions are going to be best for long-term treatment of insomnia. We don't have meds that are good at that, and I'm not sure that that's the goal ultimately. When there are chronic sleep disruptions, it is nice to have those options. So in that case, yes, the research is important, but we want to really focus on those patterns around sleep hygiene. There are therapies, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which is number one recommendation over any medication. And then meds certainly can be helpful. There are life disruptions. People get cancer, people get divorced, kids get sick. Really, being able to establish sleep is important. And for short-term treatment, sometimes those meds can be lifesavers. But we don't want to use them long-term if we can avoid it. The timing of when people use them is important. Their age is important because they might metabolize the medicine differently. Using the most effective, lowest dose is important so that we're not experiencing side effects. But hopefully that gets at it. Meds can be helpful short term. We want to use other therapies and sleep hygiene patterns where we can.
Great. Thank you.
Long-winded, I know. Sorry.
Well, no, it was a long question, but I think it's an important one because I think it affects so many people.
Yeah, it is very common.
Yes, yes. So let me do this. Let me take a next quick commercial break, and we'll come right back.
Have you ever wondered why you can't sleep well? Well, there could be lots of different reasons. In order to figure it out, I wrote the book, Why Can't I Sleep Well? It includes 150 common sleep questions that are asked and answered, and I provide all of the supporting science and evidence to address each of the questions. I encourage you to get a copy of Why Can't I Sleep Well by Andrew Kolsky. It's available at www.sleepsciencetoday.com.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we're back on Sleep Science today, and we've been talking about some of the deeper details here. I want to switch focus for a second, and this is sort of another two-parter. The first part is for Dr. Cazares, the second part is for Janet about the association. So the question is this: is there a difference in terms of age, gender, race, anything when it comes to dementia? And the second part of the question is, for caregivers of those people, what does the association offer, if anything? So let's start with the first part about the gender.
It's a great question. And one of my other roles, I work as president-elect of the American Medical Women's Association, so we're the largest women physicians group in the U.S., and we are very often talking about sex and gender equity in healthcare, and so this comes up especially in dementia, and we do know there's a distinct sex-based difference in the rates of dementia. So specifically talking about Alzheimer's, two-thirds of those with Alzheimer's dementia are women. We previously thought the going explanation was that women live longer, therefore they have more Alzheimer's dementia. That is just looking less of a reliable explanation, whole cloth. So there are likely other things happening there that increase the risk for women. And certainly, as I talked about, psychiatric illness being a risk factor, we just know that women more than men experience anxiety and depression. That's a risk factor for dementia. When we talk about menopause, there's a link between the neuroprotective aspect of estrogen, so probably the age at menopause is going to turn out to be a risk factor, still coming, and numerous other things. Women are often more caregivers than men with folks with dementia, and sleep is insomnia is a very common experience for women, not only through years where they're experiencing menses and that can disrupt sleep, but as well through pregnancy. You had a whole episode on that, I think, and child rearing, as well as through menopause. So that risk factor of insomnia may turn out to be something as well. But there are sex distinctions for sure, and we know this in sleep as well. There are different patterns of insomnia for men and women. And sometimes even with the same type of insomnia, it's experienced differently.
Wow. Okay. So given that, then, from the association's perspective, what type of resources are available, you know, with all this great information that science has been able to provide to us, how do you all put that into practical application?
So for the association, as I continue to say, you know, it's all about raising that awareness and education. So whether it's gender differences or sex differences or even race and ethnicity and how, you know, Alzheimer's and dementia may impact different communities, we do have specific webinars and virtual education programs that we provide throughout the year to make sure that we are meeting communities where they're at. And those specific ones, especially around race and ethnicity, are also addressed, you know, different challenges, including language or cultural differences and things that, you know, families may interact differently and also tackle on a dementia diagnosis differently based on culture or, you know, the community that they live in and access that they have to resources. So we do have a lot of education programs around that. I think the other part is we do a lot of presentations. And so, you know, coming up in the month of June, we will have Dr. Cazares talking about Women and Alzheimer's for Alzheimer's Brain Awareness Month. We're always looking to be able to have these nuanced and specific programs because we know that people have different questions and interests and concerns. And so those programs allow us to dive in a little bit deeper to be able to address some of those specific questions and be able to also learn from those communities of what are the resources that people are looking for so that then we can go back and, you know, try to be able to provide those solutions.
Fantastic, fantastic. So, you know, let's move to some of the practical challenges. So let's say if typically we have elderly people start to experience dementia symptoms. Maybe you've got a husband, wife living at home. The kids have, you know, grown up and moved on. And then one of them starts to experience dementia symptoms. The other now becomes the caregiver. You know, probably in a lot of families, there's limited resources. And it can be exhausting if you're overseeing someone who is wandering or has a tendency to go out the front door and, you know, next thing you know, they're down the block. What types of resources are available, or are we just not there yet?
I can jump in.
Jenna,
So for I'm going to go back to that 24/7 helpline. Again, we can cover a wide range of questions, but I think the other part is the association and all of the different chapters. We have a wide network of community partners. So we are not the experts at everything. We actually don't provide direct services, but we certainly have trusted partners in our communities that are able to provide respite care. Daycare services, different things to make sure that families are well equipped. And I think the other part that we do is we are really dedicated to advocacy. So, you know, when there is a treatment that is approved, you know, we are on the front lines making sure that policymakers understand the importance of giving people access to those, you know, to those treatments or to those resources. And so we kind of wrap our arms around the whole journey and all the different aspects of it so that families know that they're supported through, you know, all the challenges.
So I would just echo what Janet pointed out. It really takes a network of organizations and partnerships in every community, because once a diagnosis happens, it's real and it's life-changing, not just for the individual, but for their care partner, their family, their friends, neighbors. And so countries around the world are going to be grappling with this as we see rates of dementia diagnoses increase over the next quarter century and potentially beyond. It's going to take every community, state, country to come together and see how do we want to engage ourselves and our communities to take care of those with this illness. So it's really crucial that organizations like Alzheimer's Association exist, and the work they do is just awesome.
Well, I appreciate that, but you raised something there that I you know, wanted to ask about because I didn't think about it. Is there a difference between different countries in terms of the rates of dementia? Do you know anything about that?
Well, I would say this. I can't speak explicitly to that. You did ask a little bit earlier about differences in age and ethnicity as well. I'll just put in a plug. As we in the research community really have an awareness that we have to have good representation in studies. We cannot, it's traditionally just is what it is. They're largely white male subjects, and we have to do better than that because it just doesn't give us reliable science. It's a poor return on investment for public, and it doesn't tell us much when we go to treat the global population. So we are realizing that there are differences in rates. I can speak in the U.S. amongst Hispanics, Blacks, Whites, and rates of dementia. And I think right now the general thought is that this is associated with comorbidities and healthcare inequities. So a lot to do. And so to get back to your question about global rates, unfortunately, as is often the case, it does relate to these comorbidities, but it also relates to the healthcare system and how people can access it. And that's just so important. And these will also be decisions that we have to make as nations and communities about how we want to make sure people can get good care for those with dementia.
Great, thank you. So we're at the point of the show where we're basically almost out of time, but I want to ask my last question to each of you. So my last question for you, Dr. Cazares, is this. Give us the biggest tips that you can for what people can do in terms of mitigation and prevention.
Oh my gosh. So there's some very simple ones, and we actually have new healthcare guidelines. But I would say, as I did for any intervention that someone can pick for themselves that increases their health, even midlife, even later life, will decrease dementia risk. So this is not a hope is lost. This is written in the stars, and what will be will be. What we do have control over are the things that increase our overall health, and where we can take steps to improve that, then I think we ought to. Really, whatever we put in the bank, we'll get out. Getting screened for hearing loss, so critical. Only about a third of folks who have hearing loss have hearing aids in the U.S., and hearing loss is a clear link to dementia. So it's just really decreased input from the brain, probably decreased socialization as a result, and that's a risk factor and something that we can easily do. And then really interesting data actually coming from Wales and UK about shingles vaccine and getting that later in life and just kind of preventing reinfection and reducing dementia risk. So simple health preventive steps that we can take that really can have a big impact.
Wow, that's great. I never even heard about the shingles connection before, but that's wonderful.
Published this April.
Wow, brand new. You're hearing it here first, probably. Okay, and Janet, in terms of the association, you've shared with us a lot of the great resources that are available and what you all do. And my final question for you is there anything that we didn't ask about that you haven't had a chance to share yet? And can you again repeat the phone numbers, websites, ways that people can get in touch?
Absolutely. So I think, yes, we have lots of resources, but one thing that I do want to encourage everybody is, you know, there's still a lot of discomfort around this topic of dementia. You know, again, whether it's culturally or in your community or even in your family, some people are not comfortable talking about it. So I would encourage anyone that is concerned or has questions to do your research, right? And also to create that network around you. There's so much support in all communities. There are lots of different community-based organizations as well as healthcare providers and systems that have all kinds of wraparound services to make sure you're not alone. So I would say, you know, just take a look around you, build that support system around you so that you have the resources so it's not as daunting of a journey. And as always, please, please, please use our 24/7 helpline, which is 1-800-272-3900. And for any questions that you might have about any of the topics we covered today or for additional resources, our website, alz.org, is a great resource.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again to both of you for taking the time to not only join us today, but for the work that you do, because each one of you provides such an incredibly important resource related to such a scary area for many. So thank you for joining us. We look forward to having you back again in the future and having some new discoveries and new studies that we can talk about. I'm always excited to hear that. So thank you for joining us, and we will see you all here on Sleep Science Today on our next episode. Be sure to visit us at our website, www.sleepsciencetoday.com, where you can sign up to be on our news list and get information about the show and about sleep. Thanks so much. We'll see you on the next show.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.